Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're taking you on a culinary journey back to the Middle Ages.
We're talking about food in a knight's castle, but not quite the way you might imagine.
You mean we're not looking at the knight's own feast table?
We're looking at what the servants ate. The ordinary people in the household who kept everything running. And honestly, that's far more fascinating than the grand banquets.
Because it shows real everyday life. Not special occasions, but what people actually had on their plates day after day. How they got by.
When we talk about the Middle Ages, we are roughly referring to the High Medieval period here. So around the 11th to 13th century. The era of classic knights' castles.
The Crusades and a truly sophisticated food culture that developed during that time.
A lot was happening. And the kitchen of a castle was a surprisingly complex system.
What fascinates me so much about this, in the reenactment scene and at living history events, we try to recreate exactly this kind of cooking. Cooking authentically over an open fire, using the ingredients and methods of that time.
It brings you closer to the challenges people faced back then.
No refrigerators, no supermarkets, no preservatives from a packet. You work with what you have and what the season provides.
And that leads us to the three main topics we are going to
cover today. First, preservation. How did people make food last?
Smoking, sorting, and drying were the main methods. Without these techniques, nobody would have survived the winter. And each had its own
advantages and disadvantages. Dried meat, for example, had to be practically brought back to life before you could eat it.
First you'd soak it, then cook or braise it for a long time until it was soft again. That's mentioned repeatedly in old cookbooks. Sometimes multiple rounds, but not always. We'll get into the details later.
Second, we'll look at the preparation itself. What tools did the cooks have? What techniques? There were different knives and cleavers for specific tasks, but not as specialized as today's professional kitchens.
And that led to an interesting custom among guests.
They brought their own knives to dinner.
That was completely normal. Your personal knife was your constant companion.
A status symbol and a practical tool all in one.
Which brings us to our third point, the social aspect of eating. From tableware to taste, everything showed where someone stood in the hierarchy.
So, the same basic ingredients, but presented completely differently?
A peasant ate differently than a servant in the castle, and they ate differently than the knight. Even the seasoning was a status symbol. Bolder, more complex flavors were considered more refined.
We know this from living history practice. When we recreate a medieval meal, we pay close attention to which role is being portrayed. A cook would never have served something that didn't match the status of the person eating.
Let's start with one of the greatest daily challenges that shaped the entire kitchen routine.
And I promise there are some surprises. From medieval fast food to dishes that peasants and knights alike would have known.
Then let's dive into the fascinating world of medieval cuisine.
Let's turn to a topic that could mean life or death in the Middle Ages. Preservation. Without refrigerators, without vacuum packaging, people had to get creative.
And with these three methods, smoking, sorting, and drying, I'm wondering, was there a specific logic to when each technique was used?
Smoking for fish and bacon, salting for larger cuts of meat, drying for anything you wanted to store long term. The combination worked.
When drying, most of the moisture was removed from the meat. The result was, well, rock hard. Inedible in that state.
That also explains why the preparation was so elaborate. Because the meat had to be
cooked multiple times. First soaked and then cooked in a stew until it was soft again. That's what the old cookbooks say.
The soaking and cooking softened the fibers again and made the meat edible. Some types could even be eaten directly. Sounds like a lot of effort, but the stuff lasted for months.
With salted meat, it was similarly complicated, just the other way around. You had to cook it multiple times to get the excess salt out.
Otherwise, it would have been simply inedible. The salt preserved the meat, but if you had eaten it like that, way too salty.
Speaking of salt, in the Middle Ages, that was
a real status symbol.
England did have its own salt sources. The Cheshire Mines, Droitwich. But high-quality rock salt from the continent was still highly sought after. There were the great salt roads across Europe, from Lüneburg to Lübeck, from Halle all the way to Prague.
So the trade routes were crucial.
Salt was traded alongside silver, amber, and spices. These were among the few goods that justified the enormous transport costs over long distances.
And whoever controlled the salt controlled preservation. No salt, no preserved meat for winter.
This partial dependence on expensive imported salt naturally made control of the trade routes all the more important.
At Living History events, we still notice this today. When we want to preserve food authentically, we use the same methods. Salting meat, smoking it over beechwood. The effort involved is considerable.
But it works.
It works. And suddenly you understand why people in the Middle Ages looked forward to spring so eagerly.
Because fresh food became available again?
In winter, people lived on what they had preserved in autumn. Dried meat, salted fish, pickled vegetables. When supplies ran low, things got tight. In the worst case, they gathered wild herbs and young shoots in spring as emergency food.
That shows how essential these preservation techniques were. It wasn't a luxury, it was a survival strategy.
And the quality of preservation depended directly on status. Those who could afford good salt ended up with better tasting meat.
So it comes full circle back to the status symbol. It wasn't just about wealth itself, but also about how good the food could actually
turn out. The servants probably got the more heavily salted meat that had been boiled out multiple times. The fine cuts went to those above.
The system was well thought out. Harsh, but well thought out. Let's turn to the tools. The kitchen of a medieval castle was, no, let's say, a highly specialized workplace.
Specialized in what sense?
The cooks had a different knife for every task. Large, heavy cleavers for bones and meat. Finer blades for vegetables and more precise cuts. The knives indicated the cook's status and profession.
We know this from modern professional kitchens too. A cook identifies with their tools. And in the Middle Ages, it was apparently the same.
And as we mentioned at the beginning, things get particularly interesting at the meal itself. Because guests brought their own knives.
Because there weren't any provided?
Metal was precious. You brought your own personal cutlery. Bowls and drinking vessels were provided by the host. Everyone had their own knife, often along with a spoon made of wood or bone in a small leather case.
That makes sense. Food was placed on the table whole, and everyone cut off their own portion.
Your own knife was your constant companion. At Living History events today, it's
the same. Anyone who wants an authentic portrayal wears their cutlery on their belt. It's not decoration, it's functional.
The practice has continued for centuries.
And there's another aspect. When you eat with your own knife, you know where it's been. You know how sharp it is, how it feels in your hand. That probably also had
something to do with trust?
Let's say it was practical and personal. Only you knew your knife.
With ceramics, you can see the status.
Differences particularly clearly.
Absolutely. Tableware was one of the most visible indicators of social rank.
The hierarchy ranged from simple wood to decorated ceramics.
A simple servant ate from a wooden bowl. Plain, rough wood, perhaps smoothed somewhat over time from use. As status rose, the tableware improved. First better wood, then simple ceramics, then decorated ceramics with patterns.
Oh, and the patterns themselves indicated status too.
The ceramic designs already gave hints about wealth. Anyone in the know could roughly gauge who they were dealing with.
And where does the horn spoon fit in?
Horn was, well, not as valuable as metal, but more practical than wood. A horn spoon was more durable and more pleasant to use. Not necessarily a status symbol, but simply better than the most basic wood. Far removed from the pewter cutlery of wealthy townspeople, let alone silver among the truly rich.
An intermediate level. Whoever owned a horn spoon valued practicality, but certainly wasn't wealthy.
The nice thing about horn is also the feel. It sits differently in the hand than wood, feels smoother. And it was more durable.
At reenactment events, we pay close attention to such details. Which tableware suits which portrayal? A peasant with a pewter spoon would be just as wrong as a wealthy merchant with
a rough wooden bowl.
The small details make the authenticity.
And this hierarchy ran through everything, from the spoon to the plate, from the cup to the serving bowl. The higher the rank, the finer the material, the more elaborate the decoration.
It was a world where you could read status instantly, perhaps most clearly at the table. Let's turn to table manners. In the Middle Ages, people ate with their fingers, but there were clear rules.
What exactly?
Only the right hand, and preferably just the fingertips. Eating cleanly was the most important thing. Licking your fingers? Absolutely forbidden according to the etiquette guides. Plunging your whole hand into the food was considered totally uncouth.
That takes practice. Try eating a piece of meat elegantly using just your fingertips.
At medieval fairs, you can still see this today. Some visitors eat authentically. Others, well, just grab at the food. The difference is noticeable.
And the recipes themselves were different from today too. No precise measurements, no gram amounts.
Medieval cookbooks were more like demonstrations of culinary art. The cook was expected to know how much salt was right. That wasn't written down.
Cooking was a matter of experience, not following recipes.
Which brings me to one of my favorite topics. Pies.
Medieval fast food.
Practical, portable, long-lasting. You could take them on journeys, out to the fields, anywhere. The perfect meal on the go.
But the crust was completely different from what we know today.
Exactly. This hard crust often wasn't meant to be eaten at all.
Just packaging?
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
Often just flour and water, sometimes with a bit of fat for stability. The crust served as oven-safe cookware. It kept the moisture in the food during baking and protected the contents.
A brilliant solution, really. No expensive cookware needed. The packaging was the pot.
After eating, the crust was often passed on to servants, beggars, or animals. It was rock hard and not exactly tasty.
Today we make pies with butter pastry that actually...
tastes good. That's the big difference. Modern pies are entirely edible.
But the idea has remained the same. A complete meal in one hand.
At Living History events, we sometimes bake using historical methods. The authentic crust really is an acquired taste.
That brings us to baking itself. Villages had communal bakehouses.
The reason for that was that ovens were incredibly expensive.
To build and to maintain. Most people couldn't afford their own. Only the wealthy could.
The villagers brought their pies, their bread, their pastries to the village bakehouse. That's where they baked together.
It was also a social gathering place. People exchanged news while the bread was in the oven.
This communal culture is completely foreign to us today. We all have our own kitchens, our own ovens. Each family cooks for themselves.
In the Middle Ages, cooking was often a communal affair. People helped each other, shared resources.
The bakehouse usually belonged to the lord of the manor or the community. You paid a small fee to use it.
Were there waiting time?
Probably, but that was expected. You came early, chatted with the neighbors, and eventually your bread's turn came. No stress, no time pressure like today.
A completely different attitude toward time altogether.
I sometimes miss that at modern events. That sense of community, coming together over food and cooking. In the Middle Ages, that was everyday life.
Let's look at two specific dishes that were served in a castle. Pork with sage sauce, for example.
The sauce sounds interesting.
Ground parsley and sage mixed with hard-boiled egg yolk and vinegar. The egg yolk served as a binding agent, a technique that was widespread in medieval cooking.
Egg yolk binds sauces without flour, without starch. It creates a different consistency than a modern roux, creamier, richer.
At Living History events, you can
recreate such dishes. The ingredients are all available, and the result surprises many people.
Then we have broad beans with bacon and leeks, a dish with more complex flavors.
This was served with a horn spoon, on a decorated plate, with slices of bread. The beans softened the bread and created this hearty, filling combination.
And here it gets interesting. This dish shows the overlap between peasant and knight's food.
What do you mean?
A peasant in his cottage could eat the same thing as a knight in his castle. The same beans, the same bacon, the same leeks.
But the meaning was completely different.
For the peasant, this would have been an elevated dish, perhaps a feast, something special. For the knight, a simple addition to his meals. Everyday fare.
That's fascinating. The same dish, completely different social significance.
Similar to the tableware or access to good salt. Status wasn't just shown by what you ate, but how you presented it and what it meant to you.
The knight had his decorated plate, the peasant a simple wooden bowl, but the contents could be identical.
Then there's the taste itself. Bolder flavors were associated with higher status.
So more spices.
More complexity. Those who could afford it seasoned more generously. That distinguished the knight's table from the servants.
The servants got the simpler version. Fewer herbs, less refined sauces. The basic ingredients were often the same, but the preparation made the difference.
This runs like a common thread through the entire medieval food culture. Status manifested itself in every detail.
From the spoon to the seasoning.
And with that, we've come to the end of our culinary journey through time. We've seen how the servants in a knight's castle really ate. The preservation methods, the tools, the tableware, the dishes themselves.
A world that seems foreign to us, yet is surprisingly relatable.
If this topic interested you, feel free to visit battlemerchant.com. On the blog, you'll find many more fascinating articles about medieval history and everyday culture.
And if you're looking for authentic equipment for your own portrayal, you'll find that there too.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.